Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to New Books and Film, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dan Moran. I'm thrilled to be here today with Scott Feinberg. Scott is the executive editor of awards at The Hollywood Reporter, and today I'm going to talk to him about his article in the October 12th edition concerning the 100 greatest film books of all time. And I'm really glad to do this because Scott reached out to me to be a juror, and I was just so happy to do that. And when the list came out, I couldn't wait to see which one of my picks made it and which one of them didn't. And I can't wait to discuss the results with him. So welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Dan. Good to be with you.
So before we start, I just have to ask you this. I just have to know this. What's it like to work for The Hollywood Reporter? I mean, is it wild? Is it like insane? Like, what is that gig like?
Well, I'll tell you what. It's in some ways, it's like any other job. You go to work every day. You got things you want to do and don't want to do that both have to get done. But at the same time, if you're somebody like me who grew up really obsessed with film history and just the ins and outs of the business, there's a lot of big footsteps you get to walk in, and it does open some doors. And so I'm grateful to be there. I've been there since 2011.
Great. So I want to start, before we get to the actual list, I want to quote what you say at the beginning of your article. This is you saying this quote: "There has long been an assumption that people in the movie business and Hollywood specifically aren't exactly well-read." And you quote that that famous 1926 telegram from Herman Mankiewicz to Ben Hecht, where he said, "Millions are to be grabbed out here, and your only competition is idiots." And you have that quote from the book American Fiction, which is, quote, "Nobody in Hollywood reads. They get their assistants to read things and then summarize them. The whole town runs on book reports." And it's funny because those reminded me of William Goldman's famous line, "Nobody knows anything," right?
Exactly.
So why this list? Do you think that people like us read more about movies than the actual people who make movies? Or,
well, so I wanted to do this list first and foremost because I am personally obsessed with film books. I think I would put my film book library up against almost anyone's. I recently was at Leonard Maltin's house and I saw his, and I think he's got me beat, but he's also got a few years on me, so I've got some time to catch up. But no, I mean, I love film books. I think that it's a great way to learn about the industry, to better understand, you know, just every little facet of it. And so I've always wanted to highlight film history and film books specifically in The Hollywood Reporter. But, you know, in normal times, we're always fighting for space for anything in the magazine. And so when it became clear that these dual strikes were going to, make a lot of our normal coverage impossible, I kind of brought back up this idea and had more luck with it than I'd had in the past. And so, you know, then, what I was signing up for, though, was not even clear totally to myself, because in order to do this kind of a list and have it have credibility, you got to bring in a lot of other smart people from different sides of the business. We reached out to filmmakers, film executives, actors, actresses, writers, animators, all kinds of people on the filmmaking side, as well as tons of the great authors and writers about film, and just other cultural tastemakers. Among the jurors, you know, we've got David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker. We've got Maureen Dowd and Roxane Gay from The New York Times. Braden Carter, formerly from Vanity Fair. You know, on and on. Lawrence O'Donnell from MSNBC. Because I didn't want this to be... There have been greatest film book lists in the past where they exclusively polled, let's say, critics or authors. But I wanted something that was more reflective of the community at large, meaning it's not going to be something that totally satisfies academics. You know, there I have seen people from, you know, various film schools complain that some of these books are not as highbrow as the ones they'd like to have included. But then you get the reverse. And to me, that means we've succeeded, because no list of the top 100 is going to please everyone. But I really, as these votes came in and we tallied them, I was very pleased and proud of the respondents for, you know, providing a list that covers a ton of genres, a ton of different eras, a ton of topics. And I think that anyone, there's nobody who's read all 100, I would dare to say. Maybe they've heard of them. Very, very few people will have read all 100. So I hope that it inspires people. Ultimately, this is the main goal, to go and check out something, check out one of the books they haven't read, and maybe broaden their horizons a little bit.
Absolutely. And I love the fact that you include a checklist on the website so you can print it out and keep track of
exactly.
all of them.
Exactly. No, because I'll tell you what, Dan, the thing that got me into film in a serious way myself was the American Film Institute's list of the 100 greatest movies. And I know that I schlepped around a binder of lists and checklists and all of that and until I got through them all. And then it was on to the list of Oscar nominees and winners, which is how I got into the award side of things of the business. So I want to make it as easy and fun as possible for people to get into these books now.
Yeah. And it's great because there's, of course, and it's a very respectable list. I mean, I can't imagine too many people. We might have little tiny squabbles about, you know, sure. how could this, but in terms of, if you handed, you know, somebody who had never read one book about the movies, this list, that's a great education.
I think so. And as you say, nobody who submitted a ballot, as far as I can recall, had all of their picks make the list.
Right.
And by the way, I should say, we didn't go to people and ask for 100 picks from each juror. We asked, as you know, for 25, because I think 100 is too many.
Yeah.
10 or something is too few. And 25 is up to 25 is doable. Nobody had to submit 25, but they couldn't go over 25. And for me, I can tell you, I a lot of my favorites are not on the list, but again, that goes for everyone.
Yeah. And also, I love what you said about how it'll propel you into finding new books. Like, for example, when I was reading the list, there were ones I nodded at, there's ones I liked, there's ones, oh, I always wanted to read that. But then, for example, I never knew that Michael Ondaatje wrote a book with Walter Murch.
Right,
like,
right.
I'm like, who knew about, like, how, and of course, that's the kind of thing you'll read and everybody else will say, oh yeah, of course, that's really famous.
No, so
I'm
like, we all have blind spots. And,
yeah.
and that's the thing. I mean, a lot of people actually told me, and you may have been one of them, I forget, that the ballot itself, which was more than 1,200 titles, along with write-in slots in case somebody felt we were missing something, but they wanted to print out the ballot and just begin combing through that, because it's you know, the people like yourself and myself and probably a lot of others who voted, you know, we are, again, I'm not going to say that we've read every single one of these, but I think we've read most of them. And then it becomes a matter of, all right, let's go. We want new ones to read too. And so the ballot serves that purpose. So one of the things that we haven't yet done, but I think we will do, is probably, you know, release publicly the ballot as well as,
That's great.
You know, in addition to the titles that were written in by different people, because, you know, the more the merrier, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, you can never have too many books about movies.
Exactly.
All right. So let's dive into the list. And we're going to kind of cheat here, because we're going to do what I did when I saw the list on the website for the first time, which is what I assume everybody would do, is I scroll to the number one.
Yes.
Yeah, I scroll to the top and I'm like, all right, I'll get into the 90s and the 80s in it, but I got to see. So what I want to do is I want to go in reverse order. I want to start with number five and go to number one and get your thoughts on each one. Okay.
Sure.
So at number five, with 86 votes, we had Pauline Kael, I Lost It at the Movies, 1965.
Right. So this is Pauline Kael's writing in longer form than her other entry, one of her other entries on the list. We also have the 5001 Nights at the Movies, where it's sort of capsule reviews that ran at the front of the New Yorker. But a lot of people, what they love about Pauline Kael is when she really goes on in depth about how she feels. And so this is a collection of her writing in the years prior to her becoming sort of a more of a household name at the New Yorker. And so you get a real taste of what she's about. Even again, before she had the spotlight on her, she was already thinking fiercely independently and often as a contrarian on things like West Side Story, which was, you know, very embraced at the time of its release, won a ton of Oscars, and she is not a fan. So, you know, you can get, it's as much about reading great writing as it is the movies that she's writing about.
Yeah. And she reminds me very, you know, you have other people on the list like Andrew Saris and David Thompson, who I love for the kind of the same reason. I mean, like, I think you read David, you have the new Biographical Dictionary film on there. That's how I discovered David Thompson. And I love reading him because even when he says things and you just laugh sometimes and you think that's not true, but he's so much fun to read.
Totally. And it's the confidence with which they make these declarations. I think most of us are a little bit more careful or guarded about expressing a potentially divisive view. But I mean, Thompson and Kael, they will just, go wherever they really feel, which is admirable.
Yeah. I'm paraphrasing this, but I know that in his entry on Cary Grant,
yes,
in the dictionary film, the first sentence goes something like this. He says, you know, the first thing you have to understand about Cary Grant is he's the greatest actor in the history of the cinema.
Exactly. Which, you know, as if we're an idiot for not already knowing that. Yeah.
And that's his starting point from there. That's just the groundwork of his argument. So
exactly. But
that's why those people are fun to read. As opposed, you know, you also have a lot of books in there by Roger Ebert, who's a lot more like, he's much more of like an Obi-Wan, kind of hold your hand and show you what's great about movies.
Exactly.
But it was also good to see him represented on the list so often as well.
I he was the critic who I turned to the most as a grown, you know, young film lover. And so, yeah, we do have a bit of a cheat here is that if there are books that are absolutely undeniably linked, we count them as one entry. So for instance, Roger Ebert wrote these four books called The Great Movies, you know, 1, 2, 3, and 4. We put those as one entry because, and even he says in the introductions to those, it's not like the first was his top 100 and the second are his next one. He's just highlighting great movies. And so we have those books from him. We also have Life Itself, his memoir. And then we don't have one that I voted for, which is 2 Weeks in the Midday Sun about his experience at Cannes. It's a very slim book. It's less about reviewing movies and more about just the beautiful way in which he wrote about anything, including in this case, just what it's like to be a journalist covering the Cannes Film Festival in his case, you know, however many years ago when it was before we all had to come out of a movie and immediately file, you know, in those days, I think it was, you know, once a day you faxed in your summary or whatever, but that was one that I didn't expect it to make the 100, but I needed to at least give it my vote.
Were you like me? I'm just curious. Like, I remember, distinctly remember as a kid watching Siskel and Ebert on public TV. And this is like pre-internet, you know, pre-college. But I remember watching them. They'd be on like 5:30 or something on Sunday afternoon. And I remember thinking like, wow, like this is what I want to do. Like these guys, people do this?
it was definitely something we all got a kick out of who remember that. And I think one of the poignant things about the Life Itself book is that he, you know, Siskel had died and Ebert was dying when he wrote that book. And there was always this kind of sense that they hated each other. They were very passionately, they would go at each other. And there's a beautiful part of Life Itself in which he, you know, kind of rebuts that notion. But they were like the Muppets up in the balcony when they did their, you know, their show.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's go to number 4. So this is one, I got 123 votes. This was one of my picks, so I was glad to see this in there. This is Robert Evans, The Kid Stays in the Picture.
Yes. I mean, Robert Evans is, to me, the ultimate Hollywood character, and I was very lucky
totally.
he, you know, to get to know this guy late in his life and see for myself that he was actually like this. This was not, you know, it's a case where it's a totally, in a sense, self-made mythology, I guess you could say, where who knows, I would say a large percentage of this account is probably not true or heavily exaggerated. And yet he came to embody the character that he created. And he's just a total Hollywood, only in Hollywood kind of person. The way he lived, the way he wrote and spoke, nobody else talks like this. Nobody else, you know, I kind of did a winking reference to the style of the writing in our blurb about the book, where it's like, you know, is this book entirely true? Absolutely, you know, not a chance. But you know, does it keep you entertained from start to finish? You bet your ass it does, because his whole book was sort of like question answer. He's answering his own questions. He's, you know, hyperbolic about everything and everyone. The whole thing, you know, he was 64 years old when he wrote it, and still kind of embraced being called the kid, or the kid notorious, because it was basically, it goes back to what he claims was his kind of real start in the business, where he had been given a part in a 1957 film. He wasn't impressing too many people on the set, and then Daryl F. Zanuck comes by and says, you know, and they want to get rid of him, and Zanuck says, no, the kid stays in the picture. And so that was, again, who knows if any of that's true, but it was very entertaining.
Yeah, that is such a good book that if you found out like today it was a big fraud written by a little old lady, like it's, you right, still tell people to read it.
Exactly. And you know, it spawned first the audiobooks were just massive, because you could hear this guy,
and they're hilarious. You know,
hilarious. And then the documentary. So anyway, he was quite a character.
Yeah, I've urged the documentary onto people, and they've said to me, well, I'm not into movies as much as you are. I said, you know, just watch it. It's an unbelievable psychological portrait of this guy.
Totally. All right,
let's go down to number three. So this is 139 votes came in for William Goldman, Adventures in the Screen Trade.
Exactly. And this is one that, again, would, I think, be of equal appeal to people in the business or trying to get in the business, as well as just, you know, people who are completely removed from it but want a good story and some entertaining stuff about how Hollywood works. This is the guy who, you know, wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and All the President's Men. He was as successful and highly paid a screenwriter as anybody, and as the kids say, he did not give any F's about anything. It's not like they were going to ruin his career if he told the truth. And so he gives his various theories and opinions about how the business works or doesn't work well. And ultimately the most famous line, of course, is nobody knows anything, where he's calling out the business for, you know, all these rules. You know, you don't, for years there was this silly notion, they would say black doesn't travel, like if a black film would not play abroad. And that was ridiculous. There was no basis for it, but it was just sort of, for many people in the business, conventional accepted wisdom. And, you know, a lot of people found out that was very wrong with Black Panther or any number of other movies. And so, you know, those are not specifically examples that he tackles, but it's the idea that they're just, you know, it's a business built on rules. And in fact, many of the most successful people are the people who break those rules.
Right. You just reminded me, that will be a great, like a quote unquote double feature in your book reading, to read Robert Evans and then read William Goldman. They'd be go to
exactly.
Perfectly. They'd go together perfectly.
Exactly.
Okay. So moving to number two, another book that a lot of people have read. This came in with 140 votes, 1998, Peter Biskin's Easy Riders, Raging Bulls.
Exactly. Yeah. Biskin had been a writer and editor at Premier Magazine and elsewhere. He had written other books before, but this one, it just hit the sweet spot. He looks at the new Hollywood, basically spanning, as the title suggests, somewhere around Easy Rider from 1969. Really, he goes even earlier to Bonnie and Clyde in 1967, through, again, around Raging Bull, which would be 1980, and just looks at the people who totally changed Hollywood. They came in and sort of succeeded the studio system, the golden age structure of the business, and turned it upside down. But at the same time, those people either, you know, it's a chicken egg situation. Did they have to have hubris in order to do that? Or did they get hubris because they did it? But basically how all of them in their own way were nuts and on drugs. And again, there are people who have serious questions about some of the claims in the book, because it is not necessarily well cited, you know, or right. And as he notes, you know, a lot of these people, it's amazing they remember anything given how many drugs they did in the 70s, but very entertaining. And enough of it is true to, you know, make it just a book that's hard to put down.
Yeah, it is very hard to put down. And it reminds you of, and you know this more than anybody from your position, is that, you know, every movie could have gone sideways in 1,000 different ways. And that we, you know, you think about a movie like Easy Rider or Raging Bull, like all the pieces that had to come together to get what we just take for granted on the screen.
Totally. And, you know, again, in the middle of that, you've got people like Spielberg, and obviously, you know, just the drama that he went through trying to get Jaws made, and then how Jaws totally changes the business. And again, some people will argue for the better, some people will argue for the worse, but there's no question that this generation of filmmakers, who have also been called the, you know, the movie brats, many of them came out of film school, unlike their predecessors, all of that, you know, they absolutely made their mark on the business, and in many cases continue to.
Yeah. And the book is so good. Like, I love how you said about Jaws, because I've convinced my own kids, you know, of course, that I make them watch movies all the time, and they love Jaws as much as I do. But one thing they'll never understand is that, like, I remember being a kid when Jaws came out and what a big deal that was, and how, like, that was kind of like they grew up watching Marvel movies. So the idea of a blockbuster, that's just something that it's like the clouds or the, you know, the sun or the sky. But the idea of a blockbuster and how that was invented in the 70s is unbelievably told.
Absolutely. I mean, I think people forget that certainly, you know, just a few years before that, a movie would open in a single theater in, let's say, New York or elsewhere, but particularly in New York, and it could play there for a year if it was doing well. But there was not this idea that you saturate the movie going public in the way that you do now. And then it was sort of like, wait a minute, I think it was a very much a financial calculation. Like, if we have to pay to promote these movies each time we roll them out somewhere, why don't we just roll them out everywhere and promote them heavily at that? I mean, it's a lot more than that, but that's part of it. And again, that came, as you say, out of that era.
Yeah. Which is why also kids, you know, like, you know, these kids today, but also like my kids and younger kids, they don't know what it's like when I tell them to stand in line all day to see The Empire Strikes Back.
Right.
When
or that, if, you know, how about that, if, let's say, they love The Wizard of Oz or something that right. wasn't a new movie, the only way you were going to see that was if it, you know, once a year when it came around on TV. And
on
then
TV.
In that, be lucky if it wasn't cut to pieces for commercial reasons and all of that. So, yeah, it's weird that as movies have become more accessible in some ways, I think movie lovers take them for granted a bit more. It's like, it may be because you were forced to seek them out, maybe the type of movie lover from bygone years was just a little bit more obsessive. I don't know. I mean, then again, you have people on Letterboxd, which and things like that, where they're clearly very into it. So who knows?
Yeah, I wonder if I have a pet theory of mine. I wonder if that's the reason why you get more people like talking during movies when you go to the theater today. And they have the theaters will have these like shh warnings, like don't text during the movie. But I wonder, like, if I just romanticize my movie going past, or now I think I wonder if more people don't revere going to the movies the way you had to 30
right.
years ago.
I think it's got to be related to it. And it is annoying to people like us who remember how you used to be able to. And we're not talking like ancient history. It wasn't that long ago. You know, I remember the first time it became an issue with people's outside technology being a problem was my friend's mother went to Titanic and her beeper went off, and that pissed people off. But, you know, it is now that you can't get through a movie without somebody's screen lighting up. And I think there's also just collective ADD in a way throughout society. Nobody can focus, but anyway, I'm taking us off course.
No, that's all good. That's all good. All right. So let's look at number one. So this is, you know, when you scroll to number one and you see this book, at least I did, I thought to myself, right, that's that. Okay. There you go. That's like, you know, the Citizen Kane of film books, so to speak.
Right.
But this is Francois Truffaut, his long interview with Hitchcock. It's called Hitchcock right. Truffaut. This is right. 1967. This got 143 votes. So talk about that one.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically from start to finish the leader, as we, you know, voting was kind of rolling. We had ballots coming in through over a period of maybe 2 months. And at, I think at no time was Hitchcock Truffaut not in the lead. It was these others, as you saw, you know, some of the others we've been talking about, that they came, you know, they got very respectable vote totals, but never more than Hitchcock Truffaut. Part of that, I think, is that, you know, there are generations of people today who are in positions of power and influence in the business who grew up on that book. And maybe in, if we had gone back, you know, and done this poll 30 years ago, maybe it would have been one of these Arthur Mayer, or, you know, some of these other books that are now not really central to the conversation. But for people of a certain age, Hitchcock Truffaut was special for a number of reasons. First of all, you've got the hot young French filmmaker at a time when the new wave's exploding. People are getting into it in America as well. He's interviewing, and by the way, a former film critic himself and journalist himself, so knows what he's doing, interviewing, you know, the master of suspense, a British filmmaker who people, you know, in had sort of been undervalued by the film intelligentsia up to that point, and really going movie by movie, breaking down how Hitchcock did what he did so well. And also, I think people really, again, to come back to this idea that these movies were not instantly accessible elsewhere. Like, if you were somebody who wanted to learn about film, you couldn't just go and flip on demand and find a movie or whatever. So here they have screen grabs of these scenes that they're talking about. And you can see, in terms of just the mise-en-scene, in terms of just all of it, exactly how methodical Hitchcock was and how he did what he did. And so I think for that reason too, it was just, it opened up insight into how filmmaking works in a way that people had not had access to prior to that.
Yeah, it's such a patient book, because so many interviews you read are, you know, 500 words or 600 words, but it's so patient. And it's great too. You also reminded me that there, you know, there's that time when you said before about watching The Wizard of Oz. Well, now if you tell some 16-year-old you want to learn about movies, watch Vertigo, and they'll say okay, and they can go home and watch it 10 times in a row. But that was one of the lost Hitchcocks, and so this gave you this window into this whole idea that you can study this director.
Totally. And again, maybe the experience when you know that you're going to see Vertigo and may not get a chance to do it again in the future, you're paying attention. You're not taking that opportunity for granted. And so, but Hitchcock Truffaut, the other thing that's kind of interesting is how many of the other books on this list are clearly, and in many cases, it's acknowledged, influenced by Hitchcock Truffaut. So you've got Hawks on Hawks, which is essentially, you know, a compilation of interviews, same with Scorsese on Scorsese. But then you've got books like, you know, My Lunches with Orson, or sorry, the
not this the, is Orson that, Welles.
Yeah, the one, my what's the other Orson Welles one? Anyway, the point is there's a number of these which are clearly structurally ripped off, and not in a bad way. I mean, it was a very smart way to present it. But again, a book that I think is of particular interest to people who are in the business, maybe or want to be in the business, but would still be of interest to your average Joe, I think.
Yeah, and plus all those books, like you said, I think it's called My Lunches with Orson, but there's also the Peter Bogdanovich.
The other one, though. Yeah, the Bogdanovich one is where it's more academic. My Lunches with Orson's hilarious because it's just watching him bullshit about everything. But when it's more about, like, let's go film by film, that was the Bogdanovich one, exactly.
Yeah. Well, and it also reminds you that all of these characters who, like, I noticed that. It's so funny. One of my notes was that how many books there are, like you said, Hawks on Hawks, and there's Cassavetes. There's a book of his interviews. Yeah. And that all of these guys, like Hitchcock and Orson Welles and Cassavetes, I mean, they were such great raconteurs, and they would bullshit about things. But then all of a sudden, Orson Welles will say the most, like, brilliant thing about Shakespeare, and then he'll just keep going on about something else.
Exactly. And I don't know, you know, there are obviously some brilliant, articulate, smart filmmakers today. Like, I'd love to see something like this with David Fincher or Paul Thomas Anderson, but I guess there, maybe it's just because people are more guarded, or I don't know what it is. We haven't had really a book of in-depth interviews with the kind of this era's great filmmakers in the same way. You know, there are some of these compilations of interviews that they've done with a zillion different sources, but it's not a methodical, you know, start to finish. We're going to take a few days. I mean, Hitchcock Truffaut, I think it was done over a week on the Fox lot, where Hitchcock just understood, like, you know, he agreed, we're going to take as much time as we need to go as in depth as you want. And that, you know, people just don't do that as much anymore.
Yeah. And those guys were so good at, like, they would just hold forth.
Yes. No, he was thrilled to have somebody that wanted to hear about, you know, all of his stuff. I mean, he, especially knowing that it's like the top young guy in the business, you could argue, that is worshiping him and trying to make the argument that he is underappreciated. You can imagine that a guy with his ego would like that. And I guess I'm just trying to think what the equivalent might be for, you know, if there was to be another one of these days. Maybe it would have to be something like a Fincher interviewing Scorsese.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Yeah, that would be a great combo. Fincher interviewing Fincher on Scorsese. So those are the top five, and I could do this all day, and so could you, I'm sure. But I want to kind of like skip a stone and like get your gut reactions to some of the other ones on the list that, you know, books I forgot about, or I was like, oh yeah, that's a good one, or things I saw. So these are in no particular order, but I'm interested to hear your take on this. So one book that I saw on the list, and you have a couple novels on there. You have the Player and you have Day of the Locust, but one novel that I love, that I was so happy to see, this came in at number 47. This is Get Shorty, the 1990 novel by Elmore Leonard. Now I love Elmore Leonard. He wrote me a letter once, which I treasure. Yeah. So it's hard to find people who don't like Elmore Leonard. What is it about the novel Get Shorty that you think, as somebody who works there, like that book, like gets Hollywood?
So Elmore Leonard had worked in Hollywood as a writer for years, and I think had, you know, kind of a cynical view about how it all works out. Just like, by the way, Fitzgerald, who has on the list Last Tycoon, just like Nathaniel West, who had written and struggled as a writer. You know, there's often great writers come to Hollywood because they can get paid sometimes, but they've always been kind of looked at as sellouts for having done so. So I think Elmore Leonard got some of that dynamic personally, on a very personal level. He also knows that there's nothing that people in Hollywood, like more than having the mirror held up to themselves. It's the reason that The Artist and Argo and so many books or movies about the business are embraced by the business. So, I think there was a lot of that. It's just got his, it's a thriller. I think part of the unfortunate thing is that actually the film version, which followed in 95, and then the more recent TV version, I don't think they necessarily enhanced its standing. They weren't up to its level. There are very few movie adaptations of these great books that do meet their level. I mean, look, the last Tycoon movie wasn't great. We could go on with others, but I think that, yeah, it's just great mixture of crime in Hollywood in a way that people can't get enough of. It's similarly, I think I put as the, for each item on the list, I suggested another book that people who like that one might want to check out. And we have The Black Dahlia as another example of just, you know, kind of the underbelly of Hollywood people get a kick out of.
Yeah. Absolutely. So here's a book that I was surprised to see on the list, because I think it's been so widely discredited, but it keeps selling, which is number 18, Hollywood Babylon.
Totally. I mean, so Kenneth Anger just died within the last year, I think. This is an avant-garde filmmaker, former child star, who I don't know what his deal was. I guess he was a pretty eccentric guy, and he recognized that, you know, pre-supermarket tabloids, pre-TMZ, you know, there was, he somehow recognized that there would be an appetite for gossipy stuff. A lot of this book is just, you know, just, I don't even know how to, I think the New York Times called it without a single redeeming quality or something like that. I mean, it's all bottom feeding stuff. Like, and by the way, much of it turns out to be BS. So he claimed Jane Mansfield was beheaded in the car accident that killed her. Not true. There was a wig that flew out of the car and was photographed next to the car. And so he reported, you know, there's no fact checking that happened here, but that did not deter people from buying the book, from buying its sequel, from, you know, running with a lot of these urban legends to this day. And, you know, he had no shame in terms of showing photos of corpses and reporting, you know, scandals and things. So I my gut is to not tell people to go read this one because I think it's disreputable and kind of gross. But on the other hand, it's on the list probably correctly because it was absolutely widely consumed, widely influential. And again, the world that we live in today where, you know, with social media, people reporting stuff that's not checked out and whatever, it does, I think, in some ways trace back to this kind of a thing.
Yeah, it's very easy for people now to throw the stone into that glass house and say, well we're not like that anymore. But I think he could look at us and go, you kind of are.
Exactly.
So there's a trilogy of books on the list, and all three of them are terrific. I've read all three of them. And what's interesting about them is that, you know, one of the books that I nominated that did not make it, which is that it's okay, is there's a book called Space Odyssey by Michael Benson about the making of 2001. I think that's wonderful. And there's a lot of great books about the making of great movies, like Pulling Kales. The Citizen Kane book is on there, where she goes through the whole authorship thing. And so we love those kinds of books. But there's three books on there that have something in common, and I want to get your reaction to these. This is Final Cut by Stephen Bach, The Devil's Candy, and also Movie by Lillian Ross.
Yes. So the idea, so you said Devil's Candy,
Final Cut.
Final Cut, yeah. So these are examples of books that where a person chronicles a movie going off the rails. Now, I can take them one by one, where the really the original of these, as far as I know, is Picture by Lillian Ross from The New Yorker, who ends up embedded essentially with the Red Badge of Courage, a production from MGM that, it wasn't a disastrous movie, but it was a troubled production. It kind of was emblematic of what the issues were between Louis B. Mayer, who was still running the studio, and Dori Sherry, who would soon be running the studio. And this was Sherry's pet project, and just, you know, John Huston on set. It was just the first of its kind. But then you end up with a lot of these books that are with acknowledgement of their author modeled on that one. And so like Julie Salomon with Devil's Candy chronicled Bonfire of the Vanities, which the difference was in her case, she chronicled a movie that was an unmitigated disaster. And so it, in some ways that's more interesting for the reader because it's not just showing you how a movie comes together, but how people handle increasingly bad news while you know the stakes of the movies. And then that is even more the case with Stephen Bach's book, where you get into Heaven's Gate, where you've got the guy, the director of the movie that had just won Best Picture and who was riding high, Michael Cimino, going on to his next thing with all kinds of arrogance and just being indulged way beyond the way anyone should have been with Heaven's Gate, and how that just completely fell apart. Now in this case, Stephen Bach was, I don't think, on set every day or anything, but he was an executive at United Artists, which was the backers of Heaven's Gate, and so he was documenting the train crash from start to finish. But I think in some cases, or some of the time, from the New York offices of UA.
Yeah, I called Lillian Ross's book movie by mistake. It's picture, of course. But what's interesting about that is, of course, you'd think if you're going to read a book about a John Huston movie, okay, do The Maltese Falcon or do The Dead or Under the Volcano or any number of them. But it's so interesting that you end up reading about The Red Badge of Courage, which really doesn't impress anybody. But it reminds you how many moving parts go into a movie that you might just even watch and be like, meh.
Exactly. And you know, I think part of it is that what these all speak to is the idea that kind of comes back to William Goldman. None of these people went into these movies thinking they were making, you know, either a mediocre or a disastrous movie. And the difference between a success and a failure is often not that large. You know, it's just a couple of decisions that go the wrong way. And so I am trying to think as we speak. I mean, I guess you're talking about correctly that Space Odyssey book. You know, that's a movie where it came together. There were a lot of gambles and it came together. And certainly the Raising Cain portion of the Citizen Kane book, although that's different in the sense that it's retroactively chronicling what may or may not have happened to lead to that film. But the bottom line is that these are all interesting in their own way for anyone who wants to get into the process of just how a movie comes together.
Yeah, I was lucky. I got to interview Julie Solomon at one time, and I said, well, she said she didn't go into it to write a hatchet job, because I said to her, what's great about her book, and it's a substantial, you know, long book. And I go, you really get a sense for what like the second assistant director has to do. And you know, somebody's got to move a painting from one side of the country to another because that's what the art director wants. And she said, all these people go in with the best intentions. And I said to her, well, what's it like now when you watch Bonfire of the Vanities? Like, what do you think? Because she was there with Brian De Palma, she knew him, and she said, "I can't watch it objectively, and I just can't watch it that way anymore because I know all the people that were involved and all the human beings that really thought they were making a great movie."
I think that it's very interesting. And by the way, as you say, Brian De Palma was someone she knew who invited her onto the
yes.
set. He's the one that brought this on himself. So
right.
Again, because he didn't think he was making a crappy movie, but they're. Yeah, it's very interesting, and I think for anyone, you know, the magic of the movies gets a little bit lost if anybody who spends a day on set watching a movie being made with people doing endless takes or going to their trailer or waiting for the light to be, you know, it's not the process of making a movie is very removed from the magic that we see when we consume a movie. So these are both interesting and in some ways disillusioning to read these books, because you do realize this is a job for the people who are making it, and it doesn't always go so well.
Yeah. It's instructive to us the way that we said before about Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, is that we take, you know, we've all read those columns about like, guess who almost had the part of, you know, Don Corleone or something. And now, of course, you take it for granted that Brando's Don Corleone, it was ordained from heaven, but that could have gone 100 different ways, because I thought of that because in Bonfire, of course, now it's very easy to say, like, why would you have Tom Hanks of all people play Sherman McCoy? Like, it totally, totally doesn't fit. But Brian De Palma's not stupid, and he knows how to make a movie. But at the time, you know, like, Tom Hanks wasn't the Tom Hanks we know now. And you know, and that it's very easy to second guess.
And also, like, how many people have been rewarded for where they go against type in a part? That's often
right.
what they went for. So, you know, sometimes you can't know until you try it.
Right. And of course, as we all know, the studio didn't want Brando for The Godfather.
right, exactly. I mean, it's there's so many cooks in the kitchen of these movies that, you know, it can just be a matter of one voice that shouldn't be regarded more than the others getting, you know, it's a fluke sometimes.
Yeah. So one of the categories that really fascinated me on the list was there's a lot of memoirs and autobiographies, but what I thought was so great about the list was that there's not a lot of these like ghost written books or like things that were churned out in a hurry. Like, these are like substantial biographies. I'm sorry, autobiographies and memoirs. So what are some of your favorites on the list, or maybe that didn't make the list?
Well, I'm glad you're asking. Now I need to just think though, what I voted for. I will say that there's any number. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, but I will tell you.
Kurosawa's is on there. I saw Akira Kurosawa's is on there.
Yes, that was the nice.
Ilya Kazan.
I would if I can go beyond just autobiography and memoir and tell you a few others that I wish were on there. I know everybody thinks David Thompson's best book is the New Biographical Dictionary of Film. I actually think it's The Whole Equation, which is a book that's much more just kind of musings, but on very interesting assorted things that sort of, and by the way, it traces back that title to The Last Tycoon, where there's this a saying that there were only a handful of people in the history of Hollywood who have known the whole equation of the business basically in their head. And so this is, which was a reference to Thalberg. And anyway, it all, I just think David Thompson's a wonderful writer who knows so much. And I enjoy his reviews, but I'm less interested in his quirky takes than on when he writes beautifully about just the way the business has evolved. And similarly, a book of essays of his called Beneath Mulholland, I think was great. I had a professor at Brandeis University who's written some great books, which I voted for that didn't make the cut. They didn't miss by a lot, but Tom Doherty has written the biography of this guy, Joseph Breen, who was probably the most influential figure in Hollywood in the 30s. I mean, he was the censor and nothing got out without passing through Joseph Breen and his office. Doherty also did a great book about Hollywood and Hitler, which to me was fascinating. And you know, we can go on and on. Every one of his has been great. I have a coworker, or once upon a time coworker at the Hollywood Reporter, now at Chapman University running the film school, is Stephen Galloway, who's done nice books on Sherry Lansing. Yeah. So, this is the problem. You know, I think a lot of people, I don't know how you tackled your ballot, but for me and others who I've talked to, what I initially did was I went through all the different candidates and checked off all the ones that could plausibly be on my list. And I think I probably had like 80. And then it becomes a matter of, and when I say on my list, on my 20 of my top 25. And then it just, how do you whittle it down? It's brutal. But I think a lot of us, what we try to do is have different eras, different, you know, genres of book represented. I think that, for instance, Donald Bogle, who's on the list with his book about the way that Black people have been represented in film, his landmark book from the 70s, Tom's, it's a long, long title that I'm going to butcher, but he's great. But he could have been on there for his biography of Dorothy Dandridge or another book he wrote called Hollywood Black. And so I could go on and on forever about the ones that I love that didn't. And by the way, we all could, because Steven Spielberg, for instance, sent us his ballot. One of his picks was a book about David Lean that didn't make it. You know, we have David Zaslav, Ava DuVernay. Just, I think what's fun is, and we're going to add more of the actual ballots of high profile jurors to our website. But right now you can go on and see exactly what Spielberg voted for, Ava DuVernay, David Zaslav, Laura Dern, and we're going to add more, because sometimes maybe, you know, people are just very into Spielberg and they'd rather go through the 25 that he picked. And I think that's great if they do.
Yeah, that's a great way to do it too, because, you know, like follows like.
Exactly.
I want to, last question is what are some of the titles that you wanted that you hoped would get on there, or ones that you just thought of like after you mailed, that you must have had moments, especially working on the project where you were done, like, oh, I should have put that one on there. Oh, that's a good one too. Cause
I heard that from a lot of people. Yeah. They said, oh shit, I forgot to, you know, or you overlooked, but I think that I can tell you another one that I would have, that I had on my ballot that didn't make it, where it's an author who's still on there with two books. So don't feel too sorry for her, but Jeanine Basinger is just a wonderful writer and chronicler of film. She founded and ran the Wesleyan film program. She has all of Clint Eastwood's papers. I mean, she's great. And she's on the list with both this book called The Star Machine about how the studio system worked, and then as a co-author with Sam Watson of Hollywood, The Oral History, a very recent book. I did put her on my ballot for a coffee table book that she did called American Cinema, which I am ashamed to admit, when I was a kid, I borrowed and did not return from my library. So the years later, I mailed them a copy with an apology for, you know, it bothered me that I had done that, but it was such a great book that I couldn't bear to not have it. It was not easily locatable. But that is that is one that I had to put on my list. There are just so many. I mean, we could go on forever. How about you? What about yours? Which were the ones that you were
The one that I was surprised didn't make it was there's a book by Nick Davis called Competing with Idiots. And it's a dual biography of Herman and Joe Mankiewicz. And I've interviewed him as well. And he's the grandson of Herman Mankiewicz and the great nephew of Joe. And I thought that was such a great portrait of talent and wasting it and what the industry was like and this family, this whole Mankiewicz family where, you know, everyone else is an idiot. You had to compete with them. And
it's a great book. And I think the thing, though, that may have hurt that and may have hurt the Space Odyssey book and certain others is they're relatively new. And so people are still catching up with them. Now, that said, somehow we still wound up on the list with Tarantino's new book, the book called Cinema Speculation. We have Hollywood, The Oral History, which is also new. We have Sam Watson's book, The Big Goodbye, about the making of Chinatown. So there are recent books, a few of them that made it, but I think it's very hard to break through the noise in the immediate aftermath of being released. But I have no doubt that if we did this list again in, 10 years, some of the older ones that are on the list now will fall off and will be replaced by much newer ones because they're just fresher in your mind.
Yeah, it'll be like the BFI list where it's every, you see like where Vertigo and Citizen Kane go up and down in the top five.
Exactly. And by the way, I was really happy to see the inclusion of The Making of the Wizard of Oz, which is another book that I read as a kid. This is Algene Harmetz, who is still with us at 93 and is going to be joining us at an event, which I'm not sure where you're based, Dan, but you're certainly invited, as are your listeners, on October 28th. It's a Saturday, two Saturdays from now at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood at 4 p.m., free admission if you are RSVP in advance. We are going to do a gathering, unlike any other in history, of as many of the authors of these books as we can, as are able to attend. Obviously, most of them are, I think probably 50% at least of the authors are no longer alive. But the ones who are alive, from Ronan Farrow to Cameron Crowe to Sam Watson and Algene Harmetz, I think we've got a total of about 17 coming, and it's Eddie Muller, Dennis McDougall. I'm gonna do quickly while we're talking, if you don't mind. I want to read to you this, because it's like, this is exciting to me to have this group of people in one place, and my job is going to be to kind of treat it like speed dating. We're going to do a few minutes with each of them, and then we're going to have everybody up together. So here is our list of who's currently confirmed, and we may add some more, but we've got Carrie Beauchamp, I think some people pronounce, I'm not sure the correct pronunciation, but Without Lying Down, Frances Marion and the Powerful Women of Early Hollywood. So Carrie will be there. A. Scott Berg for Goldwyn, a biography. Cameron Crowe for Conversations with Wilder. Ronan Farrow for Catch and Kill. Nancy Griffin and Kim Masters, my colleague at The Hollywood Reporter, for Hit and Run, how John Peters and Peter Guber took Sony for a ride in Hollywood. Algene Harmetz, The Making of the Wizard of Oz. Leonard Maltin, Leonard Maltin's Movie Guide. Dennis McDougall, The Last Mogul. Lou Wasserman, MCA and The Hidden History of Hollywood. James Andrew Miller for Powerhouse, The Untold Story of Hollywood's Creative Artist Agency, A Great Oral History. Eddie Muller for Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir. John Pearson for Spike, Mike, Slackers and Dykes. George Stevens Jr. for both Conversations with the Great Movie Makers of Hollywood's Golden Age at the American Film Institute and Conversations at the American Film Institute with the Great Movie Makers, The Next Generation. Michael Tolkien for The Player, Christine Vachon for A Killer Life, Mark A. Vieira for George Harrell's Hollywood, and Sam Watson for both The Big Goodbye and Hollywood, The Oral History. So this is going to be a heck of an event, and I hope you're able to join us.
Yeah, that's great. You have to at least take a photo. It'll be like your Sergeant Pepper's photo.
You know what? We were saying this is going to be, if you remember the old photo, I think it was MGM's 25th anniversary, where they had all the great stars up there. We're definitely getting that shot.
No, that's great. That's great. So, Scott Feinberg, we could do this all day, but I want to let you go. I just want to say it's been great talking to you today. Everybody should check out the Hollywood Reporter's list of the 100 greatest film books of all time and get the checklist. And plus, more is going to be added to the website. It's a great, great film education for you wherever you dip in. So, Scott, thank you so much. This was really fun.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. Take care.